time we were in verse 3 of 1 John chapter 1, we were talking about fellowship. Verse 3 reads, "That which ye have seen and heard declare we unto you, that ye also may have fellowship with us. And truly our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ." So we had talked a little bit about fellowship, and when we think of fellowship, the English and Greek words conjure up different ideas. We tend to think of fellowship as companionship or social camaraderie. This allows us to think in terms of acquaintances that we worship with, or maybe a potluck meal as being a time of fellowship. The Greek word has a very different idea to it. The Greek word means joint participation in a common cause. This carries the idea that goes beyond simply being in the presence of one another or sharing a meal with one another. It involves working together in a cause or a movement. You're working together towards an objective. Eating simply isn't a cause. Although we may like to eat, eating doesn't fit the biblical definition of what fellowship is. When we work together at the flea market trying to reach the lost, that's fellowship one with another. We're working together towards a common cause. We're working together to try and seek and to save those that are lost. That's the idea of sharing fellowship with one another. When we have our community day here, and people work to get the clothes together and to give clothes out to those who are needy, when we have those come by and we try to reach them with the gospel as we hand food or clothes to them, those who are working there are working together towards a common cause. They're engaged in fellowship with one another. This is the idea of fellowship. It's, although potluck meals down in the fellowship building are fun, that's not the idea of fellowship from a biblical standpoint. It's when we actually engage and work together towards a common cause that we're sharing fellowship with one another. And that's the kind of fellowship John is talking about here. "And truly our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ." John now explains why they should want fellowship with himself and the apostles. It's because fellowship with him and the apostles also meant fellowship with the Father and with the Son, Jesus Christ. The Greek construction here indicates a contrast with the Gnostics. They offered some kind of fellowship among themselves, but it was not the same as the fellowship he spoke about. Remember, they're the ones who kind of believe there's a select group of them that the Christ, who they believe is the highest eon, he comes and places a spark inside of them, and it's only a select chosen few that this highest eon comes and places a spark in. And those are the only people who are going to have fellowship one with another. Remember, they look down on those who were Jews or were Christians and who were trying to live faithfully, and they certainly looked down on those who we might call heathen. They didn't have anything to do with them. Those folks were lost. They didn't get the spark. They weren't chosen. Their fellowship was only amongst a select few, those who had some select special knowledge because of this spark. John says that their fellowship is with one another and with God and with Christ. And this fellowship is actually open to everyone. As we'll talk about as we go through 1 John, it's open to all people who will come and obey the commands of Christ, not just some elect group. You see that spark that the highest eon put in people? The people who got it couldn't choose to get the spark. This is the Gnostic belief. They couldn't choose whether they were going to be saved or not. The choice was made for them by Christ. It was Christ who was going to place this in them, And so there were an elect group. They didn't get to choose. They were chosen. Kind of sounds like some doctrines we hear about today. I firmly believe that the DNA of these Gnostic beliefs persist even to this day in some doctrines that are out there in the religious world. This idea of there being an elect group is the unconditional election in the tulip of Calvinism. You see, unconditional election says that there's some people who are chosen and some people who are not, and you can't swap from one group to the other. It doesn't matter what you do if you are not unconditionally elected. If you're not chosen, you can pray all you want to. You can come to all the church services you want to. You can be as charitable as you want to. You can seek to obey God as much as you want to, but you're still going to hell. That's unconditional election. And if you happen to be one of the chosen ones, and you're chosen, you can live a riotous, sinful life. You can never darken the doors of a church building. You can engage in whatever you want to. But because you're part of the chosen ones, because you were elected, you're going to heaven. Now, there would be some arguments made, but in its truest form, that's that doctrine. And we have the same thing here. The Gnostics believed in this election idea. You were chosen to get the spark or not. The Gnostics, they could only offer fellowship among themselves in a true sense. They couldn't offer fellowship with God and with the Son. John was saying, we're offering something that they can't. Following the Gnostic message would not only prevent fellowship with John and the apostles, it would prevent fellowship with God and the Son. If you follow the Gnostics, you're going to engage in a common cause with them. You'll have fellowship with those folks, but you won't have fellowship with us. He's telling this to people that he has spent time with, people that he may very well have been in their homes. He's taught them. He may have very well baptized them. They had a relationship with one another. If you follow after those folks, even though we have a pre-existing relationship one with another, we can't have fellowship with one another anymore. And if our fellowship is broken, if you and I can't have fellowship with one another, then you can't have fellowship with God, and you can't have fellowship with the Son. You see how that works? If one is walking in the light, if one is habitually doing what God has asked, if he's faithful, and a member of the church is not, they can't have fellowship with one another. And when those lines of fellowship are broken, they're also broken with God. Verse 4. And these things write we unto you, that your joy may be full. The American Standard Version does not include the words unto you. So in these things we write we, that your joy may be full. This is because the best manuscripts tend not to include it, although it is in some. Thus we're left with the idea that John and the apostles wrote of what they had seen and heard. This does not indicate that 1 John had multiple authors, and these things should not be taken as being limited to the first three verses here under consideration. But they wrote the things that they're going to write. John wrote the things he's going to write, and others in other places wrote the things they did, so that their joy may be full. The King James translators chose your, but the ASV chose our. That's a difference. ASV tends to be a little better translation. If it's your, it kind of doesn't make a lot of sense. If it's our, it makes a ton of sense. that our joy may be full. John's saying, I'm writing these things here to you that my joy can be full. John received joy in seeing those Christians of Asia Minor obey the gospel, be faithful to it, keep the commands of God, treat one another in a godly and Christian way, care for one another, seek to preserve each other's soul. When he saw them acting as Christians, living Christian lives, it caused him great joy. We should feel that same sense of joy when our fellow Christians, we observe them following the commands of God. It should bring us joy too. Think about, John has taught many of these people. He spent time with them. He's nurtured their faith. And he sees them succeeding. He sees them growing. He sees them maturing. Think about the joy he must have felt. Most of you are parents. Think about the joy you have felt over time with your own children. When you see them do things that, wow, I'm proud of that. I taught them how to do that, and now they're doing it on their own. If you've helped them to grow and you've nurtured their faith, and you see them grow up to be faithful adults, what joy does that bring you? Brings immense joy to you, doesn't it? Think about John doing this. The churches around Asia Minor, he's spent time with them. He's taught them, he's nurtured them, he's helped them to grow. Think about the joy he must have felt. It wasn't just him, it was the other apostles too. Paul. Think about all the many people Paul taught. Just think about Timothy. What joy Paul must have felt when he looked at Timothy. How faithful he was. Even at a young age, Paul trusted Timothy to leave him behind to be the minister, to teach others, to secure their faith. Think about the joy he must have felt watching Timothy grow and be strong and steadfast, even in the face of those who wanted to tear down his faith, who wanted to draw people away from Christ. He stood firm. He stood fast. Think about that joy. That's what John is talking about here. Yes. Right. I think it could. Yeah. And we should find joy when we obey. It's sometimes tough, though, because sometimes when we obey, we have people who are not kind to us when we obey. They'll make fun of us. They will ostracize us. Well, you're a fuddy-duddy. I don't want anything to do with you. You're a weirdo. You may even have family members who will have nothing to do with you anymore. I have known those who, because they obeyed the gospel, the family has basically cut them out and told them, you're no longer part of our family. what should have been this person's most joyous occasion in his life. When he obeyed the gospel, when he had his sins washed away, he was justified, he was sanctified. And his family made it one of the most awful moments of his life, or at least tried to. He should have had joy, and his family tells him, "You're dead to us. Don't come home for Christmas. We're not sending you any birthday presents. You don't exist to us." How many of you have had your parents tell you that when you obeyed the gospel? That you don't exist to us. I knew someone in college. That's what he faced. His family told him, "You don't exist to us anymore." They were of a particular religious conviction, and when he obeyed the gospel, he was no longer part of the family. Goodbye. Good riddance. Don't come home again. Yet he should have had joy in that event. It was a joyous occasion. We should have joy when we obey, no matter what anybody says. And we should have joy when others obey. And we should share in that joy one with another. We should be a joyous people. So our first four verses here, kind of a summary. Christ was preexistent and is eternal. Christ was made manifest to John and the apostles. And because of this, John and the apostles were qualified to declare Jesus to others. John and the apostles declared him so that fellowship could exist. Without obedience, without the idea of working towards a common cause, there can't be fellowship. So we declare him so that we can all be joined together working towards the same cause. We can have fellowship. This fellowship was not only with John and the apostles, but with God, the Father, and the Son. Fellowship one with another is a source of joy. It means that much. And this fellowship is now under grave threat from the Gnostics. Fellowship is the theme, and the threat of loss of that fellowship is the occasion for writing. So now, the next section, chapter 1, verse 5, begins it. Then this then is the message which we have heard of him and declare unto you, that God is light and in him is no darkness at all. The Greek word estin, translated is found at the beginning of this verse in a number of the Greek texts. Typically, when we look at a Greek New Testament, it's the second word. There's a word kai, which is translated and, that often occurs before it when we look at what we would consider a Greek New Testament. Is placed at the beginning of this sentence for emphasis. It marks the permanence and absoluteness of the message. The specific content of the message or lesson would follow. The verb translated heard here, this then is the message which we have heard of him. This verb heard is the perfect tense and indicates a past completed action with present continuing results. They had heard the message before, it's still there with them, and they're going to convey this message, this lesson that we're fixing to get. The hymn is Jesus. Thus, the message which is to follow, one which is permanent and absolute, is one which we heard from Jesus. It is not like the message of the Gnostics, one that's simply a concoction of truth and lies that has no evidentiary foundation, and which is meant to deceive and draw you from the fellowship we talk about. They declare it. The Greek word here translated declare or announce in the ASV is in the present tense, like the word translated show or proclaim in verses 2 and 3. But it's a different form of the word. The word here means preach again. Thus, the message or lesson they're about to receive is one that they're familiar with. They've heard it before. this message is being expounded to them again. Maybe it's the second time. Maybe it's the 14th or 15th time. We think about the message of baptism for remission of sins. Is that a lesson we've only heard once here? To be honest, we probably hear that at least at the end of every sermon, don't we? That's a message we hear over and over again. There are messages that we hear over and over again. Sometimes we're that hard-headed that we need to hear it over and over again. It just doesn't sink in. But this is a message here that may be the case, that it hasn't quite sunk in. For some of these, it actually is the case. It hasn't quite taken root the way it needs to. That's why they're being pulled away by the Gnostics. So they're going to hear this lesson again. God is light. God is not the light or a light, but is light. This is a statement about his nature. It contains a fundamental truth about God. Statement is similar to one we find in 1 John 4 and 8 and 16, that God is love. This statement here is not saying that God is physical light, but rather it's using symbolic language to help us understand the truth about God. So, what do we know about light in our world? Tell me something about light. It covers up darkness, it abolishes darkness. Light is good. Is light real? I've got some things here. I've got that light is real. It's observable. Light doesn't have the quality of being good or bad. It's simply pure. Now, it's not pure energy, but it doesn't matter how dim it is or how bright it is. Light's kind of either off or on, isn't it? So it has that sense of purity to it. Light stimulates growth. Without light, we can't grow. You look at plants. If it were dark all the time, then plants couldn't grow. In fact, that's one of the ideas that helps us to understand that creation is seven literal 24-hour periods. Why? What was created before light? Plants. So if plants were created before light, and it's not a literal 24-hour period, you've got thousands or billions of years, you've got lots of time where plants are on Earth, and there's no light to help them grow. That helps us to understand that when we talk about the Genesis account, that it's seven literal 24-hour periods because the plants would have died off had it been loss of time. Well, light comes the next day, they can grow. Light stimulates growth. Light does drive out darkness. It enables man to see. It also enables man to safely walk about. Anybody ever been in a cave? Yeah, we've been to Mammoth Cave. And anytime you go into a cave on a tour, they're going to get you to a certain point in the cave, and they're going to take the light switch and go plink, and all the lights go out. At that point, you're so far underground, you actually are in total darkness. There's an absence of light. Unless somebody pulls their cell phone out But typically there's an absence of light. You can't see anything. You can stick your hand here and you cannot see it. It does. It does give us comfort. All of these things are things we're saying about light. These are attributes of God. So what it says about God? God's real. We can know it. God is excellent. Without limit, he's pure. His excellence, his moral purity, promotes growth in man. Because man's going to grow towards God. Plants, they grow towards light. You put a plant on the shady side of the house, when the sun goes, it'll reach towards the light. Same way. We'll reach towards the morally pure and upright God. His excellence, his moral purity, allows man to clearly see his imperfections. When we compare ourselves with a perfect standard, we see where we come up short. You see, we like to compare ourselves with one another. When we compare ourselves with one another, what we oftentimes say is, well, I'm not him. It's just like the publican who's praying. You know, Pharisee goes, I thank God I'm not like this guy. Well, that's what we tend to do. But he prayed, God be merciful to me, a sinner. He compared himself with the light. God is light. He compared himself with God so he could see that he was imperfect, that he was in need of forgiveness. The other guy, no. I'm glad I'm not like him. There's a sense of haughtiness and error there that I don't need forgiveness because I'm better than he is. I'm good. His excellence, his moral purity, shows man where to walk, how to live our lives. So this quality, this light, tells us a lot about God. If we think about light in our world, it helps us to understand the nature of God. It does. It's up to us to avoid those things, but he has shined a light on things that are evil, things that are dangerous to us, things that will cause us to lose our souls. He's shown us the way to go. Now, it's our job to follow that. When it's dark, when you lose power, even though you know where the coffee table is, you're still going to bump into it, aren't you? You get up in the middle of the night, you're feeling for where the... I get up in the middle of the night, I'm feeling for where the door is. Either that or I have to pick up the cell phone and shine it to try and keep waking Dee Dee up. Try and be kind and courteous. I don't want to wake you up, so I'll click the cell phone on so I can find where the door is so I don't run into it and cut my head. Probably would hurt the door facing because my head's probably harder. But that's the idea. Light shows us where to go. When it's dark, we run into and stumble into things and we hurt ourselves. The Gnostics contrast what they believed with what John just said. God is light, nature of God. Gnostics, they believed that they were privy to special information, private knowledge. Lack of ability for all man to know God. Creator world was disobedient, acted without authority. He lacked purity. Remember, the one who created the world, what they believed was the God of the Old Testament, was the one who was furthest from the supreme being, and he disobeyed. He was a naughty guy, And because of his disobedience, his naughtiness, he created the earth that we live on. And he created us. They believed the God of the Old Testament was impure. He was not upright. The Supreme Being could have nothing to do with our world, which is wholly evil. They believe that our world, matter, is wholly evil. And it's wholly unapproachable. They believe that this Supreme Being is wholly unapproachable by us. The only pure being does nothing for us. In fact, he will destroy all matter in the end because it's evil. The highest God or closest aeon, which is Christ, plants a spark in man. This has to be done for every man, removing the need to observe sin, to grow, or to walk in a certain way. The closest aeon will not be 100% pure because he's a descendant. Remember, their belief is you have a pure supreme being, and then every generation after that, purity goes away, becomes a little bit more impure. So even if it's the highest descendant, it's not 100% pure. That's not what John just said. God is light. He just said everything that Gnostics are telling you is wrong. And in him is no darkness. There's a double negative here in the Greek that emphasizes the absence of darkness. There is not even one speck of darkness in God. Now, darkness is symbolic language just like light is. And we've talked some about darkness. When it's dark, we run into dangers. Darkness has this idea that it's the opposite of light. We can't see where to go. We can't see our imperfections. There is a lack of purity. John uses this symbol to denote error and sin in other places. He uses it in 1 John 2, 8, 9, and 11, and John 8 and 12. Darkness embodies the idea of obscurity, error, depravity, sin, and ultimately death. It is in contrast to light. The two can't coexist with one another. If you have light, you can't have darkness. If you have darkness, you can't have light. Because light drives darkness out. They can't coexist with one another. And so if God is light, he can't be dark. This was another affront to the Gnostics. Their system of beliefs had a good supreme being and a bad demiurge God. Christ, the highest God or closest aeon, was less than pure but pretty close. They had made the God of the Old Testament to be the demiurge, which means he was bad. He was darkness. John, however, affirms that God, the same one the Gnostics claimed to be devious or sneaky, is light, and in him is no darkness. He has no sin. He is pure. He is not evil. So what John has said here is foundational to what's coming. God is light, and in him is no darkness. This is a foundational principle that he's going to build off of as we move forward. So verse 6, if we say that we have fellowship with him and walk in darkness, we lie and do not the truth. If we say is a clause that we're going to see appear three times, verse 6, verse 8, and verse 10. Each time it's going to introduce a doctrinal belief, practice, idea that the Gnostics had. It's then going to be followed by a statement showing why the doctrinal practice contradicts the basic truth stated in verse 5, that God is light and in him is no darkness. And a second if statement will then appear. And what follows after that will be the correct Christian practice or doctrine that must be followed so that fellowship can be maintained. Notice the usage of we here. If we say, through verse 5, we appears to have referred to John and the apostles. Now we have a change. If we say doesn't refer to John himself and the apostles, it now refers to the readers, and John's including himself. Wait a minute, a false doctrine? If we say, you who are Christians, you readers in Asia Minor, are no different than me. I, an apostle of Christ, if I say that I have no fellowship with him and walk in darkness, John's including himself in this. There's no once saved, always saved idea here. John, an apostle of Christ, is subject to temptations just like we are, and he's subject to being pulled away just like we are. Because he's using we here, we have a general principle that applies to everybody. If anyone, even an apostle, follows the doctrines and practices mentioned, they would be in error and not have fellowship with God. The hymn here is with God. The Gnostics are claiming to have fellowship with God, just as Christians reading the letter would claim to have fellowship with God. If we say we have fellowship with him, the Gnostics are saying they have fellowship with God. But what's their manner of life? Well, they walk in darkness. This was their lifestyle. Walk is used figuratively to and means to live habitually. Darkness is defined by Thayer as ignorance, respecting divine things and human duties, and the accompanying ungodliness and immorality together with their consequent misery. Thus it appears the Gnostics were claiming to have fellowship with God while habitually living in sin. That was what they were doing. We have fellowship with God, but when you looked at their lives, they were a moral wreck. They were habitually sinning every day of their life. Those two don't go together, do they? We have fellowship with God, who is light, but we live in darkness. Remember, God is light, and in him is no darkness. We are in God, but we have darkness. We have a contrast. These two don't go together, do they? Darkness also ultimately will cultivate death, because had it been thousands or even millions of years that the plants were created and then the next day was light, if they had had to exist in darkness, they would have all died. Darkness cultivates death. Sin cultivates our spiritual death. But they're claiming to have fellowship with God. John says that those who make this claim, I have fellowship with God, but habitually sin, they lie. John says, if we say this, and this is how we live, we lie. We do not tell the truth. The Gnostics' claim of having fellowship with God because of their manner of life was simply a lie. They didn't have fellowship with God. Their manner of life says that they don't have fellowship with God. They can't. Because God is light and in him is no darkness. God can't have fellowship with darkness. They can't be part of God. The Gnostics, and these were pre-Gnostics who had left the church, they likely believed they would have an eternal home in heaven even though they were habitually sinning. Such was a lie. There would be no home in heaven for these folks. Not without their repentance. Not without them leaving Gnosticism and returning back to God. They would have no home in heaven. Having left the church, these Gnostics should have known this And the Christians who read this should have known it too. And they do not the truth. What they said was a lie, and their walk in darkness was a failure to do the truth. The truth was the standard to which they were to conform, both in thought and in action. God's word, his revealed will for us, requires a response, action on our part. Truth is something we're expected to do. We do truth. The verb translated do here is practice in the New King James and the New American Standard. Both of those are probably a better rendering. Practice is present tense. It indicates continuous action. We cannot just do truth once. We have to continually do truth. We must be in a habit of doing truth. The practice of the Gnostics can be compared with what Christ said in John chapter 8, verse 12. We read there, Then spake Jesus again unto them, saying, I am the light of the world. He that followeth me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life. The Gnostics were claiming that they could have fellowship with God while walking in darkness. Christ had already said, the same John had recorded for us, that Christ said, I am the light of the world. He that followeth me shall not walk in darkness. Folks, you cannot claim fellowship with God and with the Son and habitually engage in sin. It can't happen. Christ said it can't happen, and John is reiterating here that it cannot happen because God is light and in him is no darkness. One who claims to have fellowship with God while habitually sinning is lying about their fellowship with God and is actively engaged in actions, life choices that are displeasing to God and that will cost them their soul. We done, Steve? All right, that's a good place to stop. We will start with verse 7, which will provide us the correct Christian doctrine regarding this. The Gnostics were saying they had fellowship with God, yet walked in darkness. John's going to tell us in verse 7 what we must follow as Christians. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you for listening to the Augusta Road Church of Christ. Located in Greenville, South Carolina, the Augusta Road congregation worships God in spirit and in truth in a friendly and loving environment. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for Augusta Road COC. And if you're ever in Greenville, South Carolina, we would love for you to come by for a visit.